Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you.
Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy from Paradigm Sports. Thanks for joining our second digital summit hosted through our digital arm for the Love of the Game. I'm really excited to have an opportunity to talk to all these great guest speakers. And next up on is Mike Butters, an opportunity to meet last year through hockey clinics. They shared so many great nuggets, I could not invite him for our winter summit because we're talking to a lot of hockey people. Mike is currently coaching midget hockey in Seattle for the Snow King Minor Hockey Association. But he also has a wee bit of hockey experience from playing in the AHL, GM in the AHL. Shared with me that he was assistant GM, Tampa Bay Lightning in the NHL. Currently, he's also the owner of Seattle Hockey Academy, Preferred Promotional Products, and managing partner for Players Capital Group. Mike, really appreciate you making the time for this. I'm really looking forward to our chat. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here, and let's get at it.
Okay, so first question I ask everybody, and it's, everybody kind of goes, okay, but what was it like? Like, where did you grow up, and what sports? I know you're a hockey guy. I'm assuming hockey was early on, but what other sports were you involved with as a kid?
So, grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and started hockey, I think, at an early age, just for the sheer fun of it. They threw me out on the ice. I fell in love with it, but I played almost every sport. I was a multi-sport kid. I played a little bit of t-ball when I was a kid, but primarily soccer. I got into lacrosse a bit, and then football, and was fairly, I guess, okay at football. I went to Blue Bombers rookie camp as a midget, and that's where it kind of took over for me, where I had to make a decision. And music was a big part of my life too, but with sports, played almost everything and anything. Handball, I played volleyball in high school, basketball, and then it got to the point where it's like, okay, we got to make a choice, and put my eggs in the hockey basket, and it worked out pretty good for me.
Yeah, it seemed like it. When did that decision take place? At what age?
Well, right around probably the midget age level, or probably more into junior. Like when I was in high school, and I left to play, I went to the Saskatchewan League to play junior, which would have been, I was 15 or 16 years old, played for Jerry James, legendary Jerry James. And that's when it wasn't where I was told to make that decision. I made that decision that it was, you know, you're living in a small town and you're practicing every day, and had finished high school. So there was, I finished high school early, so really put my eggs in that basket. Then in the off season, I would still play soccer and rugby in the off season, but primarily training for hockey. And I skated a little bit. You know, that's when summer hockey started taking over. There never was summer hockey before. You used to kind of lace up, you know, a couple weeks before the season and knock the rust off. And then these new rinks decided to stay open in the summer. So, you know, I just started playing more and more hockey just because I love the game so much.
Right. So you're kind of the epitome of the late, getting into the, like, especially late instead of early, which is, we'll talk about that later. It's a big pain point of mine when I get 6-year-old kids that are playing year round. I just think that's the wrong model. So what was your greatest memory when you were growing up in all these sports, your fondest, that you were most fondest of?
Any? You know, I don't know if I have any. Of course, all most people think about, you know, winning or championship things. And I get asked the question a lot, like, what do you miss the most about playing the game? As a player, won, you know, championships at the Bantam level, won the Perlator Cup, all these different things. And in other sports as well, is from a very good part of Winnipeg where we had a lot of good kids, I guess, and good athletes. And it was never, I can think of one moment from every sport. There isn't one that really sticks out. If anything, you know, it's corny as it sounds. I was at Dieppe. I don't even know if it was elementary school. And I was the grade six or the middle school athlete of the year. And I always remember winning that because I had a crush on the girl and I was too shy to talk to her. And when I won that, she came over and talked to me. And that was my way to kind of ask her to the dance or whatever it was. And so that sticks out for some reason.
And unfortunately, my son shared with me as he was going down the pipeline of graduation, high school dances, they don't let them happen anymore, which I'm just like, it's like a lot of stuff. You know, you can't, no snowball fights, no British Bulldog because of all the stuff that goes on. But, you know, the kids today are being deprived of a lot of vivid memories. I mean, you remember that, like, you know, from way back when.
Well, gone are the days when, you know, my parents sat me down and they taught me how to use the phone. And you never call anyone past 9 o'clock and how you answer the phone correctly and how you direct the phone call if someone calls for someone else. Like, see, who's calling, please, you know, et cetera. And even in school, in high school, we had something called lifetime studies. And we learned how to do, well, we knew how, but bowling, windsurfing, how to ask a girl to the dance, how to foxtrot, jitterbug, jive, all those kind of things. I mean, they taught you how to interact with other people, and it's a big part of society that's missing is that yeah. human communication, you know, with technology the way it is and all of that. We've got to find a way to link the way we used to communicate with people and in the old days, right? I say the old days, but and how we link with them today and how we connect with and it applies to coaching, it applies to life. But I always find it's that daily discovery is how to link the old with the new, with the modern day player, the new player, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Hitchcock got a lot of kudos the year that he got Coach of the Year because of the way he was able to connect with the millennials. Now, fast forward, next generation of kids, what I've coached pretty much is Gen Z after 96. The upside is there has been a shift from the millennials where they're really text-driven, and you know, not really having the face-to-face communication. Gen Z are kind of like coming around full circle and say, hey, you know, we prefer this kind of eye contact and having somebody verbally talk to us instead of, God forbid, everywhere I go, it seems like I see these young couples sitting in a restaurant. They both have their smartphones out. They spend better part of their meals, like, on the phone. And, like, it's killing me. Like, what happened to, like, having a conversation? Like, you're there with your girlfriend, like, hello, you know, if you would have done that, or if we would have not had a conversation that we're not having a girlfriend, right? Like,
right. I mean, you know, and I take away access to phones with my players, and I did it at the junior level. We did it at the pro level, and I do it with the 16U's as well. And there's a lot of pushback from parents on that, but when they see it and they travel with us, they come and see these guys interact when we're having a team meal. And for the first time you do it, you know, you take the phones away, or they know they haven't done it before. They don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And after 10 minutes, they love it. And they're like, you know, I have my players now saying, are you going to take the phones away this weekend? You know, like, we kind of want it. They're almost saying, like, we hope you do, because, you know, you build that camaraderie and hockey. I'm biased, but hockey to me is the greatest team sport because there are no starters and, you know, guys that ride the bench. Pretty much everybody plays, right, at every level, including the NHL. Everybody plays. And on any given night, one guy can be the hero, yeah, or two guys or whatever. So to me, that's the greatest group of people to be with, because you're all supportive of each other, because you never know. You could be the hero one night, the goat the next. And so everyone's supportive, and there's kind of an even playing field, and it creates that camaraderie. You know, Microsoft did a great article in the late 80s, early 90s, when they started ramping up their hiring, and it was specifically to do with hockey players and why they preferred to hire hockey players and train them rather than have a good computer whiz, and that because they understood the teamwork and a lot of the culture in the Microsoft, and I'm right in the bed of it here in Seattle, right, and a lot of our association members at Microsoft guys, they refer to those things as team and teammates and you know, coaches and leaders and stuff. And it's really the vernacular in the business world has taken over. And I think a lot of that is to do with the way that we construct our world in hockey, you know?
Yeah. And that whole deprivation of the team sport where kids are pulling out like in record numbers now, or we're all running and butting our heads up against it. I think they were depriving. And when kids quit by 13, the core motor skill is what they're developing up until then. You know, 9 to 12 is really, you know, more skill, core, especially in hockey, core skills. 13 and beyond, that's the group dynamics, the teamwork, the communication, the leadership, camaraderie, all that stuff that they get out of it. They're not getting it anymore because they're not playing it anymore, which is, that's part of the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, because it's killing me that they're not getting that. There's no other place to get it. They go to the workplace and, you know, you see kids on their phones and like, hello, it's a right. team like we're working on here. So I know that Microsoft, they got Google's big on it as well. Amazon is a monster in terms of the team development. And you got now two of those three are $1 trillion companies. So if you want to get into those companies and make good money, you got to be a team player.
Right. Right. You know, they when I talk to my guys even now after the game, I asked them the other day, you know, I was trying to explain to them playing four games in 3 days and what that fourth game it feels like. And I said, how many of you guys play chess? Two guys on my team. I said, okay, well, how many guys play Fortnite? Now everyone starts laughing, like, oh yeah, the coach knows what Fortnite is. I had no idea what Fortnite was, but I got to learn so I could relate to them on their level. It's like you can always gauge a coach, right? When you're talking about somebody, okay, guys, when you drive down the wing, you want to go like Yari Curry. You're looking around, like, okay, hang on a second. You got to go down like Mike Bossy. You know, too soon. Oh, Connor McDavid. They're like, oh, okay, I get it. And we always have to continually remind ourselves that we're one generation away from obscurity, right? And so we have to stay current with the vernacular for these kids. So I'm like, okay, what is Fortnite? What I understand you go around and you shoot guys. Well, the point I was trying to make with the guys is that a Sunday game when it's your fourth game in 3 days, there's going to be a little bit of mental fatigue and physical fatigue, and you're just trying to simplify your game and manage the game, right? Manage, because they're at the level now at 16U where I think at, you know, 16U, especially A1 or AAA or that the elite level of that, they want to be there. Like they have aspirations of playing in junior or playing in college or even the pros, you know? So the more nuggets you can give them, and I've played for some great coaches in my life, you know, Jerry James being one of them, Barry Melrose, Barry Trotz, Doug Carpenter, some of these greats. And I always say this, I learned more about life than I did about hockey from these guys. And I learned a ton about hockey. So I learned more about life. Jeff Brubaker's another one. I talked to Barry and Jeff Brubaker on a regular basis. I mean, I have problems with my power play. I call him. Or if I have problems connecting with a player, I call him. Like, how did you guys deal with this? You know?
Yeah. I mean, having access to those amazing people, I mean, you're kind of in a different space. Like most new sports coaches can't pick up that phone, Barry Trotz, and say, hey, I need insight. How, like, look at the job you did with the Capitals, how he made all the, and there's a lot of young players. But yes, there's the Ovechkin and some of the veterans, but there's a lot of young players on that team. And he took them to a place that they never, ever got to before and was amazing. And then, lo and behold, they decided not to renew his contract. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, that was
bizarre. Well, that, you know, that was kind of a difficult thing because he had an option in his contract, yeah, from what I understood, that if he did renew, it was for such a low rate that he had no choice. I mean, yeah. I guess they could have tore it up, but I know you just never know. A lot of moving parts, especially, and I've been involved with a big organization like that where sometimes you look at, not that I'm with them anymore, but when I was with Tampa, we had a guy named Julien Brisebois who is now the GM. Well, he was the assistant GM after me when I was in Norfolk, and he ran Norfolk, and you knew he was the next up and coming guy. Well, Yzerman just stepped down, right? He just moved into an advisory position, and I'm just speculating here, but I'm thinking a lot of that had to do with Julien is such a gem of a GM or a hockey guy that they kept it. That was the way they keep them, because Seattle would have grabbed them or someone else would have grabbed them. So sometimes moves are made and you don't know why. Right. And if you're in behind the curtain, sure, you know why, but sometimes the average person watching the game, but to your point of connections and stuff like that, I always say this to young guys, you know, when I had my junior team, I had a junior team for 12 years and everyone would say, we had a lot of success. We won our league in 12 years, went to nationals four times, won it. They say, well, that's because you have connections. And I said, I say this to every young coach that asked me that. I said, but I had to start somewhere. I had to make that first call or shake that first hand. And I get asked, you know, I was a pro scout for years. I get asked from young guys up in the rinks in BC. They're like, I want to become a pro scout. Can you help me? I got all the time in the world for those guys. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to give you four or five things to think about, to do. If you ever want to call me and you have a question, by all means, here's my cell number. Give me a call, mobile number. Give me a call. But at least help them. And I said, and the key to that is just find another guy like me, then find two or three. And I joke with them. I say, because you don't have to call me as much, right? But you said, guys, and I'll call again. There was a guy, I happened to, through Barry Melrose, I got to know Steve Levy. And my junior team in Helena, the reporter, the local sports guy, he was in Helena, Montana, one of the smallest markets in the world, right, the planet. And he wanted to move up. He wanted to be an anchor for ESPN. I said, I called Steve, and I said, Steve, would you mind taking 15 minutes with this guy on the phone and kind of just give him a little pep talk? And guys at that level are happy to do it, you know. When fantasy leagues were first starting out, I was still in midget or junior or something. I had a buddy I worked with at the keg, and he was in this fantasy pool, and it was eight guys, and they put in money, and, you know, they do their fantasy thing. Out of the blue, he told me this story. It's great. His name's Gord Davidge. He called Pat Quinn, right? And he called Pat Quinn from Adam. He got his number, and I don't know how he got, but he got a hold of Pat Quinn. He goes, hey, can you tell me, is so-and-so injured tonight? Is he going to play tonight? And he goes, who are you? So, situation. And Pat Quinn says, I'll tell you what. He goes, I will answer. He goes, I'll take your calls a couple times a year when you do your fantasy thing, provided you never tell anyone and give them my phone number, but no problem. So that just goes to show you, a guy that's waiting tables at the keg can call the GM of an NHL team and get his time. It's just either having the gumption or you know, just a way to do it and access those people, because you know, most guys you talk to, I'm sure they're more than giving for Paradigm and help and be a part of it.
Yeah. And that's what I've been finding is people all want to, basically we're all in it for the main reason, regardless of what level we're at, we're all in to develop, whether it be minor hockey or junior or our players at the professional level, we're all in to develop those players, not just in their core competencies, hockey or whatever sport they're playing, but help develop them as people. And if you're an advocate to do that, they're all over it. They're like, okay, you know, I can't imagine Pat Quinn answering phone call fantasy, make some money. But the other side of the coin is anybody at a high levels has kind of had to pay the dues and go down the path. And I'm all for helping, you know, these coaches that are just starting out, because they're going to be making a ton of mistakes. And if we don't help them out of the gate, all that's going to end up doing is hurting those kids, and they may not keep going down the pipeline in the game. And that's why everybody is this whole domino effect, right?
Yeah. You find mentors that have the time for you and are willing to do it. And, you know, one of my mentors when I was young was Bobby Clark, when I first started coaching in the minor leagues. And my owner was telling me to play players that I necessarily weren't going to play them in certain situations. And I told Bobby about it, and he said, welcome to coaching. I said, what do you mean? He goes, you're never a coach until you're fired for no reason, or you play personnel that you don't want to necessarily, or don't fit in your scheme. Because when you're told to do something you're not comfortable with, now you're a coach because you're answering to a guy. And it was his way of basically saying, welcome to the fraternity. But he was really great. And Jerry James being another one, just helping you along the way. Barry Melrose is another one. Like, I call him on a regular basis. I still call him, you know, because we're always learning. We're always trying to get better. Yeah. And they just give you little nuggets to hang on to. And if nothing else, you feel good about, you know, someone taking the time to listen to your struggle or what you're struggling with and the message you're trying to teach. And I always, again, generally speaking, I think coaching, to me, what wakes me up in the morning is you have a direct impact on the lives of young men. And I'm not just saying hockey. I mean, the hockey, that stuff is great and we love it, and that's why we do it. But, you know, again, with my junior team and in pro and stuff, I had a lot of winning teams, a lot of championships, and everyone talks about that, 11 straight league championships. I go, that's not what turns me on. When I get a call from a 25-year-old player that played for me in junior, he went on to college and played in college, and just calls me out of the blue to say, hey, Butts, thanks. Like, for what? I get teary-eyed. Like, when they call, I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, no problem, you know. But inside, I'm bawling. I'm like, this is great. Like, you had an impact on this player. Like, I still have a, you know, I had a player when they got out of junior. Luckily, I was transformed into, I moved into Tampa. Some of these guys graduated from college. And I went to the owners and the GM. I said, can I get 4 or 5 tryout spots in the American League for these guys graduating college? They want to play in the East Coast League. Can I do it? Well, they go, well, what for? Do they have a chance of making it? And I said, no, I just want to pay them back. You know, they
did.
This one kid comes to, so I had 5 kids 1 year from my junior team. And the week is up, and I get a call from the GM. He says, Mike, you got to let those guys go, but we want to hang on to this one kid. And I'll get to his name in a second. So he did pretty good. Preseason against Philly, et cetera. He did really well. Let's keep him around for another week. Great. That week, just having him longer when all those cuts were made, guaranteed him an East Coast League contract. He goes to the East Coast. He gets a call from AIC, college. And he calls me and he says, Mike, I need to ask you honestly. He said, butts, not Mike, but I got an East Coast League contract. AIC just called me. They want me to be an assistant coach in college. He goes, do you think I have what it takes to be an NHL player? And I said, it was tough, right? I said, this is the toughest conversation I'm going to have with a player, Mike. I go the coaching route. Like, you can always play the game. You can play the game when you're 60, 70. I play with guys in their 80s, right?
Yeah.
You can always play the game. And it's just one man's opinion. And if you think I'm wrong, go for it. But you're out of college. You're 25 years old. The chances are very slim, but you have a lifetime to get to be a coach. So he does that. He's now the associate coach at Arizona, D1, you know, Mike Fields is there. And to tell you the character of this guy, quick story. In Montana, we had our team. We had a bunch of elementary school kids come to sing the anthem. And they all line up on the red carpet, and we put the microphone out there, and we realized when they started singing, their teacher didn't show up. So they got, you know, oh, say, can you see? They get hot, and then they forgot the words. And so there's an awkward moment. And my instincts was, I'm going to hop off the bench and I'm going to help these kids, right? Someone beat me to it, Mike Field. He raced over there in his gear, kneeled down with the kids, put them around, and he sang the anthem with the kids. And it's one of the moments in hockey I'll never forget, because that is the quality of that type of player. Mike Field was just a quality guy, and I'm so happy to see him excel in coaching, and I know why, because he's such a positive guy and he has a positive impact on everybody he's around.
Do you think he got that positive from the coaches that he had through as he was going through the pipeline?
Oh, 100%. I think we all do. You know, I look at myself, whether it be good or bad, I'm the byproduct of the coaches I played for. And I was very fortunate from a very young age to have some coaches that I think from the time I was in Pee Wee all the way through till I retired from pro, maybe one coach where I would go, you know, maybe not really shouldn't be in the game, but the rest of them were fantastic, you know, and probably the best one, they all great at different things, but the best thing that I learned about coaching from Barry Melrose, because I was that guy, I was a fourth liner, a third set D in the American League. And he made me feel that if I won my 3 or 4 shifts a period, that our team would win. Not only did he make me feel that, he made the fifth defenseman and the first defenseman and the second line winger. He made everybody feel that if you did your job, that we would succeed. And he's just an amazing – he was light years ahead of his time in coaching, because he really cared about the people. I learned so much from him and the connections and how he would connect with players, because I think that in today's world, that's the most important thing is, you know, you never want to be a guy's last coach. And that's my number one goal going into every season. I tell the parents that you never want to, my goal is to not be their last coach. Some players are going to elevate to junior. Some are going to go to high, wherever. Some are going to play men's league. It doesn't matter. I just don't want to be their last coach and have them turned off of a great game because of what you did, you know, and everything else falls after that, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, you're kind of nailing a lot of questions that I'd be asking later. The connections, that's the key. That's the key component. If you look at all the high-level guys, and it's not just hockey, think of Pete Carroll, what he did with the Seahawks. Yeah, they've been struggling. I'm sure you've been following them. Like, in the last couple of years, it's been kind of tough for them, but the other side of the coin is he did an amazing job bringing them to the Super Bowl, had that tough play at the end, and win the Super Bowl the following year. Why?
Because he owned it. He owned it. It wasn't even his call. And the city of Seattle was ready to lynch somebody.
Yeah.
And it was the offensive coordinator's call, and he gave the okay, and he owned it. I have ultimate respect for him, because at the end of the day, it falls on you, right? The puck stops here. And he owned that play. He goes, well, that was my guy. We made that decision as a group, and, you know, it didn't work out, and I'll take that.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And many would defer that or pass Blaine or whatever the case may be. He didn't. He accepted it and they moved on, and they win the following year, pretty handily the following year. And now they've kind of struggled. Like a lot of teams go through the rebuild stages. What's your take on Quinville being like that?
We were just talking about that the other day.
Just curious, because I just wonder what you're thinking about that one.
All my hockey buddies, they'll call me and they don't even say hello. They're like, Quinville, discuss. You know, I think there's a cycle in hockey, and he happens to be the sad byproduct of that cycle. You know, they were a team on the rebuild. They found a very good coach. They won three cups with him. It's not like the message was getting stale. He's a positive guy. It's not like he became less of a coach or a more diminished coach. I think as coaches, if you're truly invested in coaching, I don't think you ever take a step back. If you do, it's a minor step back and you move forward. He's getting smarter. He gets more experience. He's better at what he does every day. I think it's just a matter of a team that's struggling and they have to say something to their fans at the pro level. And you know, some say it's maybe some management preservation by axing the coach. I don't know. But they're in that cycle of not quite a rebuild. They still have their stars. And someone's got to pay the price. And I'll go back to Bobby Clark. He always said, Buttsy, they can't fire 20 players. You know, they always look to the one guy.
Yeah, coach is always the guy that goes first. And so they have to go with the sinking ship, right? So they're going to go after him first. It's kind of like Desjardins was let go from the Canucks just before they started their amazing prospect build, like all these kids that they've got in the pipeline. If he had an opportunity to work with those kids, I think they would have flourished a little bit more, but you know, it's the nature of the beast. It is a business, and you reach that level. It is all about dollars and cents now.
But they say at the NHL level, I don't know who they are, but they say, right, coaching is 5% of the equation. Okay, and there's a lot of truth to that. You know, Chris McSorley, Marty's brother, played for Chris, and Chris is a very successful coach in the minor leagues. He said something to me he's just got that little grin. He says, you know, Buttsy, you don't have to be the best jockey if you have the best horses. And I'm like, okay. Like, you know, that was his take on coaching. And he's got many more. But the point, I guess, being is at that level, if it's only 5%, that 5% still has to be part of the equation. Like, everything has to fall in place for the Caps, right? And Barry Trotz, that was a part of it. Like, that was the right time, the right players. He got players to change their game just enough to buy into a plan that was going to succeed. And in Nashville, he had all those years in Nashville. He just never had that one go-to guy that was going to put them over the top, right? And Nashville is incredible for what they had for talent. I scouted them for years, I know. Overachieved year after year, and just then they made the big trade for Suter, and they started to spend a little bit of money, and look what happens. Next thing you know, now they're still riding that wave. But I think so with Quinville, it was just a matter of he's in that downturn now. Like DeBrincat's doing well for them, but some of their developmental players haven't. Maybe they don't have a lot in their system. And so it's that downturn while they re-energize. And sometimes you last through a coach. Sometimes you make a change. But I don't think they're not firing him because he was a bad coach or guys got tired of him. I always equate it to baseball. The LA Dodgers. When I think of coaching, I think of Tommy Lasorda, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they won. You think about all their success. But there were some years where they won 40 games. And 35, 50 games, the dismal seasons. But did they fire Tommy Lasorda? No, because he is what he is, you know. Now, I understand that some coaches, and we're talking about the high-level guys, right, their message maybe can wear thin with pros because it must be hard, or it's got to be hard for a guy making $6 million a year. It shouldn't be hard because you play because you love the game, but it shouldn't be hard. But for a guy making $6 million a year to go, what's that guy telling me for? He only makes $300,000 or whatever they're making now. I know they're making more, but not more than the players, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think there's that component of it, you know, and it's just a matter of guys staying relevant. You know, Mike Yeo, they brought Mike Yeo into St. Louis. It's horrible to say this. I like making predictions, and we do a sheet at the start of the year, me and four or five of my buddies, who are the first three coaches to get fired, right? My order was John Stevens, Quinville, and I think I had Boucher in Ottawa. And Boucher was with us in Tampa. He's maybe an alternative thinker, but he's an incredibly smart hockey guy.
And you've coached or been in the space for a very long time. You get it's 18 individuals. They're all different. And the sooner that you figure them out early in the season, the better off you're going to be. Hockey's a long season. But think of some other sports like you played rugby. I played rugby. Those are short seasons. Football, relatively short season. Softball, even more. So if you're just relying on, you know, the team concept, and you're not going to figure out each one of those individuals, you can't push their needles. And the kids that are kind of selfish in that respect or critical of their own teammates, you kind of, that's one of the tactics, is giving them ownership to say, hey, you know, let's steer the ship in this direction instead of going that direction. It's great that he turned the corner.
Right. Well, you know, I think it was a saying we had, I used early in my coaching career, and I know I didn't invent it, but they used it in Miracle. It was funny. It was like, I think Herb Brooks, and I say it to guys too, it's like, why are you blaming that guy? You got more problems in your game than a math book. Why don't you work on your problems? And then, okay, and then we'll work on his problems too. And to get them to internalize their game, because if they feel that they've got enough of their own stuff to work on, they're not going to worry about the deflection and stuff like that. And again, it's an ongoing, it's an ongoing education. I don't think – Scotty Bowman said, everyone says I know the most about hockey. I don't know 1/100,000th of what there is to know. Well, if arguably the greatest hockey mind knows that, well, then what do I know? What do you know? What do we know, right? And it's putting that investigation or that investment into education and coaching education. And for I deal with it now. I'm the coaching coordinator at Snow King, right? Not only do I coach a 16U team, but I also work with all the other coaches. And one of the things we've done a lot of things to try to communalize or to get together on some of our philosophies, you know, Positive Coaching Alliance is one. We've got Huddle. We've got Hockey Share is another program to get everyone on the same plan as far as like USA Hockey does a good job with the 8Us and 10Us as far as playbooks, drill books and stuff. At that point, it kind of fans out. Right. So we've managed to get a lot of the key things that we want to teach in the game to coaches that maybe aren't as experienced, like all of my drills. You know, it used to be you'd see in a whole huddle group in the back doors of an arena when I first started coaching. It's like a drug deal going down, right? It's not.
I'm not giving you my drill. No way.
You got a good 2-on-0 back check drill? Yeah, I got one. Here you go. Give me a regroup. What's your best regroup drill? I always judge coaches by that. I shouldn't judge, but I always kind of do when you ask a coach for a drill or what's your favorite drill, if they're really resistant to share that with you, it's like, look, having a great drill is not going to get you to the promised land, whether winning be your goal or whatever your goal is as a coach. It's not going to get you the promised land. And we're here to help each other and develop our players and especially at this level. So working with these young guys that with some have no experience, you know, it's invigorating. Not because I can just share them what I know, but I also direct them and to gather information. Like, not all of it works. You know, I'll tell you, when I started coaching girls about 3 years ago, and I started a girls program down here, and I probably did more research and reading about coaching female players than I ever did as a coach, just coaching hockey. And it wasn't like I wanted to teach the game differently or share differently, but it was just how to communicate with the female player. And one thing that I learned from it, well, two major things, is that females at that age are very linear. I don't mean to sound sexist or anything. It's just studies of Prune, psychological studies. Mm-hmm. They're very linear. So when you draw something up, you know, you draw, okay, I want you to go in. Oh, look, I got a board right behind me. Look, we're going to get fancy. You go into this area, you go right here. Well, the female player will do exactly that arc and get right to there, when really you're just trying to get them to go in the general concept of it. And the other one was to never single them out. So if a girl had a great game And I, you know, if I, one of the most detrimental things you can do with the female players to say, you know, Sally had an unbelievable game. Let's hear it for Sally, you know, and stuff, because they don't want to be singled out either good or bad. And those aren't sports studies. Those are just psychological studies. And so when I had to change my delivery and the way I explained it, because I saw we're very fortunate here in Seattle. We've got a couple U.S. Olympian female players, Brooke Whitney's being one of them. And there's two, Kelly Stevens. And Kelly Stevens spent a lot of time talking with my team, my girls group. And it's just the message, the way she delivered it. I'm like, these girls are hanging on every word. Yes, it's probably because she won some Olympics, but it wasn't just that. And so, again, if I wasn't able to adapt, I probably wouldn't have succeeded with that group and had them achieve some of their dreams, you know, some of their goals and go to college and those kind of things. And that's kind of why I love the level I'm at now, because they're not getting paid, right? They're at a level where they love this game and they want to get better and they want to learn as much as they can. And they're like sponges, right? So whatever you can give them to help them along the way, you know, like my goal, I'll tell you right now, my goal as a coach with this group, this age group is, I told you one, was not to be their last coach. The next goal is to move them, help them move to whatever level they want to get at. So if it's junior, and every guy, you know, I ask them, how many guys want to play junior hockey? They all put up their hand. Okay, well, now I've got 18 job functions to do, is to try to get all those 18 guys. Are they all going to go to junior A or major junior or, you know, junior B? Maybe not. But they're going to get to junior. I'm going to do what I can to find something for them, because one thing that youth players don't, a lot of them don't understand and their parents don't understand, is there is a program out there for every kid.
Yeah.
Now, it might not line up with what they want. You know, they want a D1 scholarship. There's only, you know, roughly 52 teams, 6 recruits a year, 300. There's 300 available a year worldwide. Okay, so now what? Well, there's D3. Have a parachute. And it's not a bad thing. It's very good hockey. Played hockey pro with D3. ACHA club. There's some phenomenal ACHA club programs in the U.S., you know. Lindenwood being an example. They got a huge endowment from the St. Louis Blues. Rick Zombo's their coach. I've had some players go there, and they had a choice between D3 and club. They went to club. They love the experience. They're playing $6,000 a year to go to school at a high academic college, and they still have the same choices coming out, right? Mm-hmm. If they're good enough, they're going to keep going. If not, they're going to play, you know, men's league.
And yeah, there's a beer league, right?
Yeah. No, I say beer league. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, we're not even allowed to say those words anymore. It's got to be adult recreational safe hockey. That's what my son's playing at 19. He's playing tier 1 adult level instead of playing junior, because one of the reasons he didn't want to pursue junior is A, a lot of the camps were money grabs that we went to, and B, they like the goonery. I mean, he now is starting finally to watch hockey again because he's loving the skill. And that's one of the next question is, what's your take on the new NHL? The speed and the skill, is that amazing you? Like some of these kids that are coming in and how young the teams are now versus, you know, 15, 20 years ago?
I love it. I talk to guys every day that says, oh, geez, I wish there was the old days of this and that and the other. I used to do that. Unfortunately, that's how I buttered my bread when I was a player. I had to, you know, have my gloves drop once in a while. Yep. And I watch today's game and I'm just, I love it. I love it. And I hope it equates to the average fan, and the attendance seems to be good in that, because it is such a fast, skilled game. I tell some of my 16-year-old players, I'm like, you know, son, you handle the puck better than I ever handled it. I was a 9-year pro, and you handle the puck better than I ever handled it. Like, you just keep emphasizing the skill with these guys, because that's what it is. It's a skating game. You've got to be able to skate to play the game now. And it's great, because now – it gives more opportunity for the players that want to advance in the game, because they don't have that intimidation factor. You know, one of the biggest steps the USA Hockey made was they take kidding out of Bantam.
They take it out of Bantam or Pee-wee. Maybe Pee-wee?
Pee-wee.
Yeah, because Canada took it out of Pee-wee as well.
And they showed me videos. You know, I was on that committee, and when they put the ADM together and all that stuff, but sports psychologists were involved. Coaches from every level, from the NHL down to termites, are involved. And now they're talking about taking it out of Bantam. And I think there's a big disparity. You go to a Pee Wee game in Canada, you'll see kids that are 4 foot 6 and kids that are 6'1" at Pee Wee. And so now the playing field is a little bit even. It's bound on skill. And it used to be you could actually have a role in the NHL starting in junior as a pugilist, as a tough guy. I don't know why you would ever go down that road, but, you know, I never did. I never planned on it. It just happened. But now you have more of control over what your body size doesn't matter. You can be any size, any shape. If you can skate and have skill, a certain skill set, that role has been so diminished in the league. It's not there in college. You don't need it. It's one less thing to worry about.
Yeah, I got a few quick questions so that we can wrap up. You spent time with USA Hockey ADM. You've used the reference. Can you give like a dummy down version of what ADM is for coaches? Because many don't know what it is and come into clinics and or LTAD. What's your take on the two?
So ADM, the best way to conceptualize it is basically putting kids in small areas and playing a series of small area games. Focused on how it was created was everyone's been to a peewee termite game where the puck's dropped and one guy grabs the puck and he goes end to end and he scores every time and everyone just chases the puck. So we brought the game and made it smaller and went to half ice games, smaller ice games in small areas where kids got more puck touches. They're forced to make plays in tight areas. And the studies have found and shown and illustrated that not only does it help the lesser skilled player advance his skill, but it also helps the higher skilled player. We've all seen that player at 11, 12 years old that could go end to end. Well, by the time they get to 14, they can't do it every time. By the time they get to 16, players catch up. And those guys have, because they haven't learned how to play with skill and stick handling and deception, because they've just used their speed to get around guys. And guys drive wide. Now we've taken the game and made it, but like just like soccer, you take, so I don't know the size of the balls or whatever, but when you're a kid, you use a little ball and you use a little bigger thing. It's like we have the blue pucks for the young kids, right? Because the puck weighted that big is we've taken the game and condensed it and made it. We do a lot of that. I mean, even at the 16U level, we spend a lot of time with ADM style drills and small area games and the fissure that has happened up until probably the last 2-3 years is they always say, is the ADM working? And we've got the first generation of Olympians here in the U.S. to gauge that by. Well, that first generation finished 6th, and everyone thinks that was a disaster. I go, well, maybe on the scoreboard. But if you look at that team versus all the other teams, including Canada's, they had the most skilled team. Top to bottom players, their skill level was unbelievable. They just didn't know how to link the game. And so right now we're going through a little bit of a change in USA Hockey where the ADM is still there, but we're linking it to the 180-foot game or the 200-foot game. So it's a series of small, you know, small passes to advance the puck, small area games, all the way up to the offensive zone, because you're looking to execute that one little play in that one little area, but you've got to do that all the way up the ice, right? Yeah. So They luckily the NHL gave some seed money to USA Hockey. They took that money, created the ADM program, and it's now given coaches an incredible resource to access drills that they don't maybe necessarily know the why, and the coaching in essence is teaching kids why, right? But at least they've got the first link of that is to show them the drill and put them in there. And a lot of it too is we're going back to just pond hockey. Is playing games. Like the discovery that you make as a player. I used to run home from school in Winnipeg. I lived a block from school. I'd rip home, grab my skates, and I'd head out to the pond. And we had, well, the pond, we had outdoor rinks there. And there was 3 rinks. And the old guys would skate on one rink. And you're on the second rink was the medium age guys and the little guys. And once you got a little better, like, hey, Mike, come on up, skate with these guys. They need a guy. And it's like, you called up the pond. But you're just playing with no rules, and you're inventing moves, and you can try things that you haven't tried, and there's no pressure to succeed. And if you do succeed, you try it again. And we get back into that. Like, you know, like I adopted this drill. There was an old coach in my junior league. His name's Rickard Granberg. He's the head coach of the Swedish national team now. And he does a drill at the start of every single practice. And you think that would get old. And it's, I'll tell you the coaching aspect of it. The coaches sit there with one whistle, and they all lean on the boards. They do nothing. You put the players in a confined area with a puck. National team players, you put them in a confined area with the puck. On the whistle, they blow. They speed up. On the other whistle, they slow down. Nothing else, right? Because in the game, you've got to play at high speed. You've got to control the puck. There's so many things. You're working on your edge work. All of these things are being accomplished by a simple drill, and the guys are told, you know, I think over the years we tried to mechanicalize. Is that a word? It is now. It's mechanicalized again. We put too many cones and tires and things on the ice, and we're getting away from that now, which is nice, is to give them those areas to create those plays and let them discover that. So there still is a lot of those, and that's where AAU in the U.S. has come up. And I know you have the same thing in Canada. You've got some of those pugilists that are saying, I can't believe they would have peewees playing cross-ice hockey or 10Us playing cross-ice hockey. Like, I'm telling you, as a guy who never got to play that, I wished that I could play cross-ice hockey because I see the guys coming out. I'm coaching 16U here right now, and I go out as a coach coordinator. I got to visit all the teams. I watch our 12Us and 10Us and 8Us, and I'm thinking I'm got to hang on for a few more years because I want these kids when they come up. They're so skilled.
Yeah.
Because they've always got a puck on their stick. And the other thing ADM does is it puts the kids together by ability, not so much by age. At 8U, it used to be 8U, first year, second year, and you go all the way down to 5U. Now they put them together by ability. And we had a program at my rink in Montana where I was with Tampa, so I was on the road a lot. My wife calls me. She goes, your daughter wants to quit hockey. I said, why? She goes, well, you got to ask her. She comes off the ice crying all the time, and she's not really much of a crier. And I saw I went out on the ice, and I watched it a couple times, what they were doing. And when they would scrimmage, sure, it was cross ice. One kid would have the puck and would go through all the kids, and everyone would chase them around. They never got to touch the puck.
So the simple fix,
what do? Throw 5 pucks out there. That was the simple fix. Then we throw soccer balls out there. Then we throw other things out there. We have games where there's multiple touches or you have to pass the puck before you can make a play. So everyone gets involved in the game. And that's where you start building those players. Like, we have a slogan here at Snow King, like, it's building players for life, right? Is how do you take that player at 6 years old, and you don't really have to teach them to love the game. If they're handling the puck and getting to play, it's the best game in the world for that. Kids love it, right? You just put a kid on the ice with a stick and a puck, and he gets to whack, and they love the game. But how do we build those guys for life? Because our whole goal is, obviously, when you're an association, you want numbers and you want kids. It doesn't matter if the kid's on my team at the highest level at 16, you know, A1, or he's at the lowest level of 8U C3 or whatever it is. It's like we're doing the same things with, and this is all part of the ADM program, is getting them to handle the puck more, touch the puck, pass the puck, shoot the puck. Even with goalies now, they've invented new gear where at the younger levels, we have a hard time with goalies. Right, finding goalies. Well, they now have gear that you can put right over your shin pads on your goalie gear for the younger kids, right?
And so they convert from player to goalie in a practice
during the game.
Yeah,
during the game, you just slap it on them and go. And now we've got because just like you asked me, when did you make that choice of multi-sport to single sport? Think about the goalies. When do they make that choice that they want to be a goaltender? It's probably not going to be till later, right?
Yeah,
they should try. They should try those other things. Like, we have fun practices where my players say, can I go on goal tonight? Sure. And they're 16U. Sure. Never know. Bob Gainey never made it to the NHL till he's 15. Or he never made it, played hockey till he's 15. And it worked out okay for him.
Yeah, he's a pretty good player. Yeah, they had a pretty good team, too. There was some pretty good supporting cast. Last question before rapid fire. What can we do? What are the top three characteristics in your eyes? I mean, you've coached, and you've played all the levels. What are the top three characteristics greatest coaches you either had or you've witnessed?
A lot of it probably comes from reading. I read a lot of coaching books. I look at motivational talks like TED Talks, those kind of things. I watch those all the time. I don't know if it's necessarily coaches that I've played for, but I mentioned the ones that are probably the most impactful and are great coaches, like Barry Melrose being one of them, Jeff Brubaker another one, Barry Trotz. But I go to probably my top coaches or the guys that I read the most of. John Wooden would be number one. His message, his pyramid of success, His books are unbelievable. His talks, his message, and you watch all of the players that played for him, how they speak about him, and he never talked about winning and losing, ever.
Yeah, he won it 10, never came out of his mouth. It was all about never, success, but winning never. Was not a never.
Ever. And I have adopted that when I probably 7 or 8 years after I started coaching, I got more into the educational part of it, reading and stuff, and adopted that from him, because if you're successful at what you do and you have the right personnel, you're good. Winning's a byproduct of that, of being successful. Right. And so Wooden would be one. The other one I gravitate to, which was, I don't know if anyone has, is Tarasov. It is Anatoly Tarasov, the guy who, basically, he's the father of Russian hockey. And everyone thinks, you know, in the old Russian days, and you could go to Tikhanov was the second coach, but Tarasov, his messages and talking to his players, it was the way he communicated, even when his players, like the old stereotype of him was that he worked his guys to the bone until they bled and all that stuff. And it wasn't. That didn't come until Tikhanov's time. And Tarasov was always like, so what if we're skating? We're skating hard because it's fun. You could be working in the salt mines. This is fun. Enjoy it. And he was able to convey to his players, his players loved him. You know, I saw a great deal with Tarasov when Fetisov went to go visit him. And it's when Fetisov was about to defect, and he wanted to do it right. He wanted to do it the right way in the Russian culture. And he went to go see his coach and ask him. And it wasn't the message that Tarasov gave. It was, when he first met him, he drove to the town that Tarasov lived, and he brought his running shoes and his shorts. And the coach hadn't coached him in years, right? But he was like, okay, well, you know, yeah, we'll have a iced tea and we'll talk. But he had to run wind sprints and train because he was still a coach, you know? But also just his theories on the game. He knew he couldn't beat the Canadians at their game. He, instead of adopting the Canadian style, which was what everyone aspired to in his era, he invented their own style of game, and it was a skilled puck possession game, and they weren't shooting just to shoot, and so that's why I really like him. And Pat Riley from the Lakers was another one. It was like he was a highly motivational coach as far as teaching guys. He's got a book called The Winner Within, which is really good, teaching guys about success and how to use your own inner thoughts to bring out the success in yourself. And it shouldn't matter what anyone else thinks of you. It's you feeling good about your game and setting your goals and those little tiny goal-setting things. So from a coaching standpoint, those guys, I look at some of the other guys. I've read their books that are good. Bobby Knight is one. Krzyzewski's another one. Steph, I took one of Krzyzewski's things and I tried it to my junior team, and it actually to prove a point. We went to a game one time, and Krzyzewski did this with his kids. We went to a game and I had my trainer purposefully forget the game jerseys. And we had practice jerseys. We get to the rink, you heard this, doing this coaching technique. So anyways, we get to the game and our trainer, Brenda, she says, Mike, I forgot the jersey. I'm sorry. I packed the practice jerseys. I go, oh, that's okay. We'll wear those. I'll tell the other team. And the guys are freaking out. Guys are just freaking out, right? And we go through
numbers, all the bad cards.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. It doesn't matter. We'll sort out the numbers. So they warm up in their practice jerseys, and they get back in. And I said, still wear your game socks, no problem. And we get back in. I go, guys, everyone okay? And they're all freaking out. Oh, what are we gonna do? And I said, Brenda, why don't you show them what we're gonna do? So she brings in the game jerseys, right? Gives the game, and everyone's like, oh, relieved. I go, guys, what do we learn from that? Like, what can you control in your game? Can we control that we're not going to have jerseys? Can we control that the ice machine broke down? We're only going to play two periods. Can we control about the only thing we can control is our effort and how hard we work in the game. And it was great because it was a moment for that team that particular year that they took a big jump forward in not worrying about everything, you know? And so I got that from Krzyzewski. But to say there's one favorite, Scotty Bowman's another one, the way he did it. I think you can take the good things you can learn from every coach at a high level. Pat Summitt's another one. I go to basketball again, but her, you know, even Tortorella. Torts is known for, you know, guys, the message, how do I best say it? the one thing Torts does, it's, and he's softened his approach on it, but he challenges guys to be better. You're better than that. You can be better than that. Like, I've seen it, you know, and he challenges players to challenge themselves every day. And sometimes, again, in the pros, that message might be a little tough, but look at in junior hockey or even in youth hockey is to get guys to there. Now, I work more with the elite level players, right? But there's just as much importance in those guys. And so I, now that I'm working with younger kids and at all different levels, I need to do some more education. I need to research some coaching for those type of players. And, you know, I'll put you on the spot, but I mean, Paradigm, a lot of what you guys do and why I jumped at the chance to do this and love it is because that's the message, right?
Yeah.
It's like playing because you love this game. I don't play men's league now when I get asked to play because I want to go out there. I fall apart when I go out there. I play because, right? I play because I get to BS with the guys after the game. It's fun. And some, that's, I think that's the fissure between some good coaching and maybe some not so good coaching, is even though you're pushing guys and you're stroking them like Tarasov did, he still made it fun, because the game has to be fun. You ask any NHL player, maybe not, maybe nowadays, I don't know. But in my day, they would have played for free. Oh, you're going to feed us? Oh, you're going to pay us to play? Yeah, that's okay. We would have played anyway, because you want to compete, right?
Yeah.
Just the idea going out on the ice and the fact that there's, you're surrounded by glass and boards and no one can get into your surface. That's your time, right? No one else's time. It's like that old saying, like, we don't, you know, you don't coach, you don't, what is that? You don't coach from the bench, you coach to the bench, right? You never coach players when they're on the ice, right? And in a game, like,
yeah, because they're not going to hear you. They're going to tune you out.
No.
If they get that puck on their stick, especially the younger age groups, that's their time. That's their 4 seconds of fame. Like,
yeah. Most
kids don't have the puck for very much. So the last thing you want to say is do anything is when they get the puck. The average puck time for, like, the greatest players ever, like in Olympics, I think is like a minute 15 in a game. So,
well, I think the most overrated position in hockey is during a game is the coach, and the most underrated position in practice is the coach, right? Like, I always say to my players, I go, like, this is your time, guys. Like, the games are your time to show what we've been working so hard on in practice and what we're trying to accomplish and achieve as a group. Now it's your time to get to show off. This is your time. You guys go have that practice. Yeah, that's my time. And it's still going to be fun and stuff, you know.
I had a good analogy. We can't control games in any shape, aspect, or form except how we play. And you can't control how they play. Can't control what they ate before a game. Can't control any of that stuff. So you have no control over games. You have full control over practices because you can plan it to the microsecond. But you still can't really control how they do the practices unless they buy into everything you're trying to teach them. So we're on the same page with that one. Last question before a couple rapid fire. What would be your number one tip for someone that's just starting out? You've been at it for a long time, been a lot of levels. The guys that are just coming in your program, for example, what are you saying with them to help them shave 5 years off their learning curves to avoid the mistakes that we all make in our first 5 years?
Research, read, investigate, talk to other coaches, learn, right? Educate. I mean, it's so important, because the first time you use Photoshop, it takes you 22 steps to put the space in here. Next time you do it, it takes 12. Next time you do it, it takes 6. Well, you can avoid 3 or 4 steps by talking to some player coaches of experience, or getting referred to some coaching materials. But gone are the days of those back alley meetings where we're trading drills, right? There's so much out there on the internet. You know, we used to make fun of guys that, oh, that coach got his drill on the internet. You know what? I get drills on the internet now. I grabbed one yesterday. I was like, oh, you know, Boston University, they do Defense Mondays and they do this thing. I went on YouTube and I looked and I was like, okay. And learning the why, right? The key to coaching kids is learning the why. Why are we teaching this? What is the purpose here? Because in that generation or now generation of kids, it's getting to them the why. If they understand the why, they're going to fill it all in. In our generation, it was why? Because I said so. Well, it's not like that anymore, right? The other thing I would say would, in tandem with investigating and stuff like that, is connect with your players. Is find out what motivates them. You know, do you go to the whip? Do you go to the reins on players? You know, some players need a little encouragement, a little motivation. Some players need to be challenged. Some players need to be left alone. My favorite sports quote of all time, favorite quote. I don't know if this is one of your questions. I'm jumping the gun here. It applies to players. It applies to parents. It applies to coaches. It applies to everybody. I love the quote so much, I wrote a paper on it and sent it to USA Hockey. Average players want to be coached. Average players want to be left alone. Good players want to be coached. Great players want to be told the truth. I thought about that. I'm like, that is such a great quote. Now apply it to parents. Average parents, they drop off their kid. They don't care. They don't care about that. They just want to be left alone. They pay their money and do their thing. Now, good parents invest in their kids. They want to be helped. They want to be told how to help their kids. And sometimes they can be a little over exuberant and hover a little bit. And the great parents, they want to be told the truth. And they actually are the ones that maybe sit back and you know, there's one thing that's new that in USA Hockey that they've been really hammering on the younger coaches too is to tell the parents, what can you do as a parent? What can I do as a parent? Tell your kids you love watching them play. That's it.
Bingo.
That's it. I love watching you play. You know, like I have a daughter that's playing at an academy up in Manitoba this year, and I used to be her coach. And so they're literally coach hat, dad hat. And the ride home, I'm like, which hat are we wearing? It's up to you, because I'll tell you, you know, and we do that. And now when I talked to her today, she's playing at Shattuck's this weekend. And I'm like, hey, just like last weekend, I loved watching. That's what I started out with. Geez, I got to watch a couple of your games on the internet, Margo. I really loved watching you play. It's great. You look like you're having fun out there, you know. And if she asks, like my dad, if he'd ask, you know, I'd say, well, what could I have done? Well, I don't know. What'd your coach say? You know, first thing, go to the coach. Well, he said this, so he didn't say anything. I said, oh, I don't think about these things, you know. This is what I see, but I wouldn't get overly involved in her game because I'm not a coach anymore. I'm her dad. I always was her dad. But it's that as parents, we want what's best for our kids. And sometimes we set them up so much for failure two ways. One, we overcoach them or coach them, period, as parents. And the other is that old blue ribbon mentality. We've got to teach kids that it, you know, life isn't fair. There's going to be winners and losers and all those kind of things. And not the hard message of that, the good positive message of that. It's like if you play to the best of your abilities, you got to be proud of yourself. You be happy with yourself because you're doing the best you can. And if you keep doing the best you can, you're going to get better if that's where you want to be as a player. And you're going to achieve the things you want to achieve, you know? And so that would be my thing with coaches is connect with those players and find out. Now, I have conversations with some of my players, and you don't know what you're getting when they come to the rink. They could be from a broken family. They could have an overcoaching dad. They could have great parents, right? And it's getting them for that. And I know maybe not this team, but I've had teams in the past where the only hour or two of accountability and discipline and structure and fun in their life is that 2 hours they're on the ice. And so we've got to make that the most positive experience we can for them because that might be the only guidance that they get in life. I had to say, we have all of this coaching material, all of these manuals and books. They don't give you a manual to be a parent. There's no handbook, right? You have a kid and you got to figure it out. And how many parents actually do that, read books on parenting? Probably not, right? You know, so that's what I would say is like as coaches, especially when you get into the first year guys you're talking about, is maximize those 2 hours for those kids. Make that the most positive, fun experience for them in those 2 hours. And the byproduct is they're going to learn a lot about hockey without you overcoaching them. Just let the process handle itself and just research the drills you need to emphasize that skill development at those ages because it's prime. Usually kids in that window, you know, the 8 to 13 window, that's usually where they come out. There's exceptions to the rule, but that's the prime learning and prime athlete development that they're going to get. So it's so vital. Our best coaches should be coaching our youngest kids, not our older kids.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest issues with I wouldn't say it's the USA Hockey, but I know in Canada that's the big issue with our model is that our best coaches coach in junior A, collegiately, but I think they should be working with the 9 to 12-year-olds. They add them, your squirt and the peewee age groups, core motor skills, because that's when they're going to get their optimal A, development, and B, that passion, that love for the game. And you answered the last question without me even asking about the parental feedback, like what would you recommend for coaches? Because you're kind of touching around it. And one thing that you said way back when about coaching, it's kind of a closing note, about lifelong learning. You familiar with Clara Drake?
Oh, yeah.
You know one of his great quotes that he used to say all the time? If you're done learning, you're done. And that to me is like the epitome. Like it truly is. John Wooden, both those guys, like was in their 70s, they were still going to conferences and still doing presentations because they're both being asked, hey, we want to pick your brain. And then after they do the presentation, they go sit in the seats with the rest of the coaches and pull out their notepads and start taking a whack of notes.
Yeah.
And why? Because they could keep learning. That's what it's all about. That's the takeaway that I'm trying to share with all of these coaches. Whenever I interact them, like, don't think because you sat in on a 1 hour presentation. Listening to you, like all those great anecdotes, we could have talked for like 10 hours. But the key is never forgetting what it's all about is those kids. The last question I'm going to ask is you've been coaching midget now. How long have you actually been coaching at that minor hockey levels? Like you said, you coached girls a few years back because there is differences. It's been a while.
So my second year with the 16U's, I did 16U and 14U girls for 3 years, and then got to backtrack probably about 6 or 7 years. I coached peewees for 3 years.
So about 10 years worked with kids. How are you loving it, or how are you enjoying it?
I love it. I mean, a setup question, right? You love it?
Yeah, I kind of planted that seed. But
you know, I do love it because I love this age level. I said to my wife when I retired, I said, I'm going to move, you know, wherever we live, I'm going to coach a peewee team. I always thought that was going to be my level. And I just found by being around the rinks and spending a lot of time, you find where you're most comfortable. In this age, I just kind of gravitated to this age group because I like working with the motivated athlete and the young kids. They're, even though they're at that age where they're adolescents, they're finding themselves and stuff like that. They may not want the structure, but they respect it. And they won't tell you they want it, but they do. They like that because they know there's an end goal to it. So like, if I can play a part in helping these kids get to junior or keep playing at 18U, whatever it is, right? That's what kind of fires me up about coaching this age level, because they haven't been taught a lot of the next level stuff in the game, the concepts of the game. Not so much. I'm not a systems guy. I think that's, I just not as a coach, I've never been a systems guy. I'm a concepts guy, you know, to put it best. Again, we'd won our league maybe 8-9 years in a row, and one of the other GMs in the league says, well, what's your secret? You got to have a secret plan.
Secret sauce.
I go, do you want to know the secret to our game? Like, what systems is it? What is it? I go, it's simple. If we can get to the puck within a stick length, we send two guys. And if we can't, we send one guy. That's it. So we teach them, and with working with these guys, is teaching them to make that decision. And so the game is more organic to them, because if we load down our kids with systems, they're going to get to another team. They're going to have to learn a new system. Then they go to this other team. They're going to learn a new system. But a skilled player that's intelligent, has good hockey sense, can play any system, right? So teach them to think. And it's a longer process. And trust me, it's more frustrating. There's a reason I don't have much up here, right? It's a long process. But in the end, they take more ownership of it. And they love it more because it's their decision. You're just guiding them to make the right decisions. So it's like a young player who's really skilled, and you can see them like a peewee, and they look off a player, and they keep with the puck. I'll call them over, and I'll say, you know, why did you not pass to whoever there? Why did you not pass them? Well, it always comes up, well, if they get the puck, they're just going to lose it. I'm not going to get it back. I go, but you know, in the game of hockey, it's about making the right decisions, right? Just like showing up on time and wearing the right color jersey and all that. That's the right decision. So make the right decision. First thing I was taught when I was a kid was how to pass. And I make passing, it's an epidemic here in Washington State. It is an epidemic up and down. And because we haven't put an importance on passes. And I say to the little guys, so real quickly, I say to the little guys, I go, how many guys here like candy bars? What's your favorite candy bar? Like, you know, okay, Snickers, whatever. Ah, candy bars. How many guys like dog crap? You like dog crap? You know, dog crap, it stinks and all that. No, it's a, I said, well, when you pass the puck, think about when you get a pass from someone. If they give you a bad pass, what are you getting? Dog crap. If they give you a great pass and it's on your stick,
candy bar.
A candy bar. And the other kids that have a hard time making friends on teams, you know, they have some kids that maybe are socially awkward and stuff like that. You want to make friends quickly? Pass the puck. Learn how to pass the puck. You'll make friends quicker than you know it. And even at the 16 years, you know what? Make better passes. Improve your passing and you'll improve, like, you'll, those relationships will come because this is a game of family, right? It is. Think about it. The puck hogs, you know, you ever see the ranks of little kids that are so-called the puck hogs and stuff like that? Not well-liked, are they?
No.
But you have the best player on the team moving the puck to a good another player instantly. That's a nice kid. I like that kid, right?
Yeah. The 8-year-old kids, one of the best kids I ever coached. He's playing major junior now. He did an amazing, like, he's kid could score at will. I had him buy into the Gretzky rule right from day one, from the beginning of the season all the way through, even tournaments. So 3 goals, just assists to reinforce that importance of the. But he was kind of buying into it already. But his parents were kind of, you know, this. I thought I'd get a lot of pushback. He celebrated his assists that entire season more than he ever celebrated a goal, and he set up five. Like, we had 5 kids on our team that never played before. One of them was his good friend at school. So when he set that goal up, like, oh, my God. And that was the game we lost 22-1.
And that kid got the goal.
And the kid got the goal, set the goal up. And he was like, he could have scored the goal easily, but he set the kid up, just whatever. That was the whole planting the seed, you know, like, hey, passing gets the assist. Passing sets up the wins. Passing is a – and you're right. You're nailing it on the head. If it's just the scoring guys, yeah, there's plenty of them out there. But more often than not, they don't last long, right?
No. Well, think about this. The 41-0 game. There are so many ways to manage that game to make it fun that you don't have to do it. Like, you asked me my best coaching moment. I thought of one in, I think it was pro or junior. In youth hockey, we played a team, my Montana, the Pee Wee team. It was like 7 or 8-0, something like that. And we shut it down. Right, we shut it down, like, move the puck around, stuff like that. The kids on their own, and these are peewees. We had a kid on our team that was handicapped. He's a handicapped kid, had back surgery, all this stuff. The goal was that they came up with the goal. Let's get him a goal. Let's get him a goal. And they just kept setting him up, and he scored. And it was like the Stanley Cup.
Yeah,
like, it was the greatest moment in their season. If you remember, you know, those kind of things, you know. And we sometimes coaches lose sight, or parents, more importantly, they lose sight of what this is. And when I coached the girls, it was like, you know, the tournaments and the youth kids, it's sweatshirts and swimming pools. That's what it is. When they go on those trips, that it's sweatshirt. They want a sweatshirt of the tournament and they want to go to the pool, right? it's fun. And they go, well, why are you letting them go to the pool? They gotta get ready for the next game. I talked to a coach one before he gave Pee Wee's Red Bulls. Red Bulls before a game. Red Bull, the energy.
Yeah,
guys,
yeah. For that age group, not really good for that age group.
Like, the health issues with that, it's incredible. But
yeah. But
there's so many ways that you can, if you just stop and think, how do I make this a better experience? Everything else is going to fall on the line. Your drills, your level of effort, your respect, whatever that is, it's all going to fall on the line if you just make it exciting for them to come to the rink, make them want to come. Like, I have a lot. I always say I don't talk to parents a lot, but I actually do, because I want to know. I'm like, how is the experience for your kid? Well, you know, I talked to a mom today, and she goes, he loves Thursday practice. He just loves Thursday practice. We practice Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I kind of know why, because our Thursday practice is very up-tempo practice, but we start with it's one of the few things we do every week. We start our Thursday game, because usually play on the weekends, is we start with a game called Tupac. Okay. I always divide the teams up, like, different every time, and the coach is playing it, and there's a goalie on each end. One team goes this way, one team goes this way. Tupacs, go. That's it. No rules, no offsides, no nothing, and we just screw around. The coaches get to score and stuff, and they do, you know, the players love it, and they mess around, and it sets the tempo for the whole day. And it's a very high-paced, high-tempo just an hour on Thursdays. And so I think, well, geez, okay, that's great. How do I make Wednesdays like that? how do I make Tuesdays like that? You know, because you want them to be, they've got to have that inner drive, but at the same time, we've got to do a job as coaches to make them want to be excited. You know, with a lot of players, I had a hard time working out. Off ice, like youth associations now, I don't know what it's like in Canada, but they've invested a lot. Like part of the ADM program too, that's expanded, is we have an on-site scheduled paid off-ice training guy. Every team from 8U through 16U, we have an off-ice guy, and they do off-ice training.
8U, they're doing dry land? We call it dry land.
Well, yeah, but
they scale it down to the age group, so they're playing like
Boston soccer ball. Like,
yeah, different sports or something, right?
Different stuff. They're doing push-ups and sit-ups and stuff, but they're making that part of the culture of the game. Yeah. And nutrition is starting to play a big part of it too. You know, like I have a hard time conveying to my parents that nutrition is a weapon, just like a shot or a fast skater or anything like that. And they say, look, I don't want to offend you because I know you all think you feed your kids great and that you should, but every diet has some missing gaps in it. There are some stuff, there's some things out there that provide those missing gaps. And again, I'm talking about maybe the more elite athlete and stuff like that.
Yeah. But
again, we're talking about hockey, but aren't we just talking about life? Because we want our kids to be active, right? Educated. And like I've adopted this banner with my teams, every team I've coached, and it's FE and then whatever the acronym of the team is. This year it's FET. So in my parent manual, I go with the FET program, right? Family, education, T-Bird hockey, in that order. Okay. So you decide, like, if you want to miss a practice, I had a kid miss a practice yesterday because he's got a volleyball, some volleyball playoff game and stuff like that. And he comes into the audience, oh, geez, I gotta go. Is it important to you? Yeah. Well, we practice like 3 times a week. We practice 90 times a year. Good luck. I wish we finished earlier. I'd go watch your game, you know, and this isn't hockey, but I learned this from management books and things like that. I always used to, when I interview staff, you ask them, here's the situation. You've got a deadline on a project that's due at 5 p.m. on Tuesday, okay? Your daughter has a recital, a music recital. What do you do? And they always say, well, I got to get the job done. It's like, yeah. You go to the recital. It's important because if you're happy and you're doing those things for your – and you do that with your players, right? Like, would I like them to be at practice all the time, every time? Of course I would. We just don't live in that world anymore. So we got to, you know, every once in a while you got to let them go. So I like at the start of the year, the parents get to choose. Christmas, Thanksgiving, which one do you want? Because we're not playing during one of those times. It's a family time. You guys choose. You know, I'll roll with whatever you want, but there aren't enough weeks in the schedule that we cannot play on both. And because our Thanksgiving is different than yours, usually it's Christmas. So they've wanted to take Thanksgiving off this year, which is funny because we play games on that weekend up in Canada.
Because we're not respecting your holiday.
But, you know, so back to the whole thing of coaching, I think it's – and you got to love it. If you don't love it, like, you know, it's just like the players, like the players – the key to, and this is dealing with the elite athlete, but you've got to fall in love with working out. You've got to fall in love with practice. Whatever that means to you, if that means listening to music before it or visualizing yourself doing some great things or trying new moves, you've got to do whatever it takes to motivate yourself to enjoy working out and practice. Because we all love the games. That's easy, right? We all love playing the game. So find why would you not enjoy practice? And I find most of my time during the week when I come up with practice plans is thinking of, that's in the back of my head, is how am I going to make them or get them to love this practice? Even though it's a hard drill or a complex thing or whatever, it's like, where do we find the – so when our guys skate for conditioning, and I don't do the traditional blue line back right line. I don't do that. I mask it. I put puck handling drills and all that kind of stuff. But I'm like, yeah, but if they do it to times where they're really fatigued, I do the Tarasov thing. Guys, this is awesome. This is great. You're handling the puck. This is good. Keep going. We'll do it one more. Come on. We got one more on us. You know, and you're masking it. And they're like, you're showing them the positive side of conditioning. I never use it as a discipline tool.
Right.
Because what message does that send kids? We used to do that, right? They used to tell us, oh, go skate lines.
Yeah, they throw the bucket right in the middle of the center ice. Yeah.
Isn't skating
it up first?
Yeah. So if you can skate 15 lines, doesn't that make you a better player and you're not tired? So why make that a punishment? You know, so we have conditioning factored into some of our deals. It's always with a puck, though. We don't do any conditioning without a puck. They always have a puck on their stick.
Yeah.
And so it's fun. And so they've got, and they're learning while they go. So instead of chewing up the ice and just going blue line back and stuff like that, it's crazy. And then you challenge them. How many can you do? You know, how many stick handles can you get while skating full speed from this, you know, this spot to this spot and around? Count them. So they now, okay, how many do you do? 18. Okay, well, shoot for 20 next time. You know,
yeah, we could go on for hours. And then, yeah, we could keep going and going and going, but I'll end it because I want to respect your time as you know. I mean, thanks so much for this. I actually almost got two from you.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook, For Love of the Game, Twitter, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.